All right, hi, so my name's Andy Bissett.
I'm James Allen.
And this is the Ball Chat Sports Podcast.
All right, so welcome to another episode of the Ball Chat Sports Podcast. I am absolutely delighted to be able to welcome the Spanish Inquisition onto the show, Liam Flynn. He's been a great admirer of our show since the very beginning, probably one of our first listeners. He's helped us out massively on the show in the past, doing sound bites for us. And chipping in with his feedback and all his positive enthusiasm over the week. So I'm happy to welcome you on as a co-host today, Flynn. Very, very good to have you.
Thanks very much. Look, long time listener, first time caller.
That's it. Yeah.
But yeah, no, really happy to be here. I'm sure a few of the listeners there, you know, they're friends of ours, so they'll already know me. But for anyone who doesn't, my name's Liam Flynn. Like Bissett and Jim, I'm from Birmingham in the UK. But unlike Bissett and Jim, I'm living in Barcelona at the moment. First thing that comes to mind is, you know, I don't really know anything about sports, so I'm wondering what Bissett and Jim were thinking getting me on here. But happy to be here.
We know you're a personality, mate. So obviously it was a difference between, you know, obviously we spoke last week or a couple of weeks ago now that Jim was going to be sort of like, you know, struggling to have as much an involvement in the pod. So we thought, you know what, we need someone to fill the gap. We need someone that's got some enthusiasm about the pod and can come on and just chat ball with us, just like me and Jim have been doing for the last 9 months. So, yeah, so that's why you're on, son. You're just here to have your input, man, have your input on everything. And we're going to start off with, you know, the preamble ramble that we've been doing for the last few months. And I'm sure you can have an input on this, because the rumors in the world of NFL are that estranged Houston, Texas quarterback Deshaun Watson, who has 22, I told you it was 13 the other day, 22 right, sexual assault allegations and 10 criminal complaints against his name from 12 different women. So this has all been dished up amongst a trade with the Miami Dolphins, which is meant to be happening in the next few days. So Watson's basically had to opt out this season with Houston prior to the surfacing of these allegations due to discontent with the team's ownership. So that was his own prerogative. But to sum up these allegations that we know about him, the women in question are basically massage therapists that are unhappy with Watson's conduct during their therapy sessions. And apparently he was like rocking up naked and asking them like to play with his butthole. So like,
oh, no.
Urban Meyer, we see you. He's in the same cut from the same cloth, obviously. But Flynn, I want to get your opinion on this. Where do you stand on it? Where do you stand on a player that's got all these sexual assault allegations against him? And the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, has basically said he's okayed the trade, and he hasn't said yes or no about whether he'll be suspended. What do you reckon?
Well, first of all, it's clearly an awful, awful story. It's a terrible thing. I loved how you said, Flynn, you'll have some input on this. Let's talk about sexual assault. But yeah, no, jokes aside, it's a terrible, terrible sort of thing. And then obviously with these sorts of stories, there's, you know, people like to say there's a bit of he said, she said kind of thing. But this is 22 different women coming forward. I think it'd be very unlikely that there'd be some kind of conspiracy, you know, that these women are conspiring against him. This looks pretty damning to me. I'm no expert in the field, but these, you know, this was the same as the, what's his name? The Harvey Weinstein thing. It was pretty clear that the guy was doing these horrible things, you know, and just hearing what you're telling me there, it seems like a similar situation. But did you say they're refusing to suspend him, or they're not sure if they're going to suspend him?
Well, he's currently playing for the Houston Texans, and he hasn't been playing all season due to kind of like a breakdown of relationship with the coaching staff and the ownership there. So he's been waiting for a trade basically all season. And the trade deadline, I think, is on the 5th of November. So it's coming up. It's in about a week. Mm-hmm. And there's talk of him going to Miami Dolphins. There's been, I think, other teams touted about in the league. So he could potentially line up for a team in, say, 2 weeks and have all these allegations still against his name unresolved and still getting paid, you know, millions and millions of dollars. So I think it's striking a bit of a nerve in the industry at the minute, in the whole NFL sporting world, about whether this should be allowed, really. So I think NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, he has got the power to say, like, look, he's suspended, like until these allegations are cleared, which I think would be a good move. But it's also a massive risk for any team that wants to take him on, because if they take him on, and they give away all this draft capital, so they give away all their picks, or you know, they trade another player, They're also taking a massive risk.
I see what you mean. I think business perspective, it'd be a bit more prudent to suspend him, even though, you know, even if nothing's been proven yet, just to take care of your brand while this nasty stuff is going on. We're just going to keep you on the side. If it all turns out you're innocent, cool, let's crack on, you know, and then if you're guilty, well, you know, you're gone basically. But yeah, my mind, I don't own any football teams, but that seems like a better business perspective to me. Look after the brand, you know.
Yeah, I think there's an element of risk and reward there for sure. Like, obviously you've got a responsibility to make sure that your brand stays clean and stays detached from these sort of like allegations. But also, if it turns out that these allegations are untrue, then you've got like a top five quarterback in the league. So there's a massive risk reward factor there. And also, you know, we get a lot of these women that come forward. They get treated like they're just trying to grab money because of these there's famous sports stars. But as you say, the volume of the allegations is quite damning for Deshaun Watson. So it'd be interesting to see what happens in the next few weeks.
Absolutely.
So we'll move on to the five things that you might have missed. Number one, last week in the American League Championship Series, this is MLB. So the Boston Red Sox became the first team in history to launch multiple grand slams in a single postseason game. So this happened in back-to-back innings in the first and the second to launch Red Sox into an 8-0 lead in game two of the series. However, the 9-5 eventual win by the Red Sox was not enough to cement the series win, as they eventually went down 9-1 and 5-0 in the final two games to lose the series 4-2 to the Houston Astros. The point of this is grand slams. Basically, it's when all the three guys are on bases and somebody hits a home run. That happened twice in two innings, and it's never happened before in history.
I saw footage of that, actually. Yeah. I had no idea what I was watching, but the crowd seemed to be really into it.
Buzzing. Crowd were buzzing.
Yeah. You could tell something special had happened. It was a huge reaction from the crowd.
America's game. They love it. All right, number two, Diego Simeone's son Giovanni scored four goals for Inter Italian Serie A side Hellas Verona against serial chain smoking and ex-Chelsea coach Maurizio Sarri's Lazio on the weekend. The 26-year-old has spent the majority of his career bouncing between various Italian teams, but seems to have found his feet on loan at Verona. The two goals in each half were slammed past former Liverpool great Pepe Reina as well. So this guy, obviously his coach, he was a great player, turned out to be a great coach. And now his son is doing it, man. Four goals for Hellas Verona, killing it. Because we had a bit of a segment a few weeks ago about sort of ex-players' sons and the sort of failure and expectations of those players. But this guy seems to be a player that's definitely doing it.
Brilliant. Do we know if his dad taught him or he's just learned himself?
Hard to say. Yeah, he's one of them, man. If your dad's like massive into football, like, and you're his son, generally you're going to want to try and replicate in it. So yeah, and your dad's going to sort of feed you into the way of like maybe the academies when you're younger. So when you're like 9-10 years old, you're probably going to get more opportunities than you would do if your dad wasn't a famous like football player. So I mean, for sure, I think he's been streamlined into certain clubs. He's always got the one up from just the regular, you know, Joe blogs that might be trying to make their way in the football world. Similar with Romeo Beckham, isn't it? Like obviously him and Phil Neville's son are both on the Inter Miami like B team, basically, aren't they?
Oh, I didn't know. I didn't know they've gone into football too.
Yeah. So Phil Neville's son and Romeo Beckham, yeah.
If I was one of them, why can't they just be like a normal rich person's son and just be a fuckhead?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, just...
But yeah, no. So who's this guy? First saw your notes on this, I thought it was Diego someone. I thought you'd not found out his surname, but it's Diego Simeone.
Yeah, Diego someone's son. Yeah, Diego Simeone. Simeone, that's meant to be an I.
this is not really done the most in-depth research here.
That's why you don't literally read the notes. You have to paraphrase, because otherwise you just... I might have said someone, I don't know, we'll have to go back in the edit and see what happened.
No, I mean, just in the text, it looks like it's written as someone, then you pronounce Simeone. I was like, oh, of course.
So, number three, man, you take us away, number three, because you've done your research on this. And I saw this last week, I saw a clip of it, and I was like, what is going on here? Is this actual competition? But yeah, it is, the Bloom World Cup.
Yeah, the Balloon World Cup. So it was big news here last week in Spain, as they played host to the first ever Balloon World Cup. So it started off as a bit of a meme, this during the lockdown. Some family in the States, they made a video of themselves playing this game online. It went viral. A Spanish YouTuber picked up on it. He's gone ahead and made an official World Cup for it. And it was brilliant. 32 teams across the globe traveled to Tarragona, which is about 100 kilometers south of Barcelona. 32 teams, they went to Tarragona to battle it out for €10,000. And one paper reported a trip to Latin America. Now, funnily enough, it was won by Peru in the end. So it looks like they're just going to get 10 grand and, you know, a free flight back home.
Yes.
Yes. So the idea is you get two players, you get some obstacles and a balloon. You've got to hit the balloon as far away from your opponent as you can. Then your opponent needs to dash towards the balloon and hit it before it gets to the floor. Now, if your opponent fails, the balloon hits the floor, you get a point. And then vice versa. If your opponent hits the balloon and you fail to stop it from landing on the floor, then the opponent gets a point.
So hold on. This has been played by youngsters at wedding parties for years and years. You know
exactly.
What I mean?
Yeah.
I remember it's being exactly a 6-year-old and having a balloon at a wedding party and just like bouncing it around off the floor. You know what I mean? Before it lands on the floor, you get underneath it and do a little tap in the air. Man, this has been played for years, man. I don't know who's going to take credit for this, but I've been playing this at least 25 years. You know what I mean?
Same.
Every time I get on a wedding, I start sliding on my knees, trying to make sure that balloon doesn't hit the floor.
And it shows in the quality of the players. You can see these guys. This isn't their first rodeo. They're going at it.
They've been playing this for a while.
Yeah. Like at the end of the final, Peru and Germany, they were fucked. They were really going for it.
Glenn, is this individual or is it team? Is it team based?
So it's a good question. It's teams, but a team consists of a player and a coach. So really it's a singles game, but for some reason they're calling them teams.
A coach, man. Do they really need a coach? Is there tactics to this?
Yeah, they've got coaches. They've hired some refs from La Liga. They've got VAR.
So it's like, did it touch the floor or not? One of them.
Yeah. For controversial plays.
So if it hits sofa, say there's a sofa in the room, for example.
That's fine.
If it touches the sofa, is it allowed to touch the sofa as long as it doesn't touch the floor?
If it hits the sofa, it hits any obstacle, it's fine. It's the floor, is like the goal.
Okay.
So it's on an 8-meter by 8-meter court and it's littered with a bunch of obstacles like we just mentioned. Like there's a couple of sofas, an arcade machine, a desk. And then for the final, there was a Volkswagen ID3 on the pitch. It must have been a sponsorship thing, but that actually turned out to be one of the most handy obstacles, because the final basically consisted of the two dudes just lapping around the car, diving and rolling over it. It was brilliant.
Yeah.
Now, you can only hit the balloon with your hands, and you can only strike the lower half of the balloon, so never from top down. So you can't just smash it straight to the floor.
That was what I was going to ask. That, like, surely you can't just like slam the ball down, because it's not going to be very interesting, then, is it? So it's got to go up first.
There's got to be some sort of skill. You've got to hit it upwards, but still make it difficult for the opponent.
Yeah.
And in that same vein, so once you've hit it upwards, you can't hinder the opponent from getting to it. So you've got to hit it up and kind of get out of the way. Mm-hmm. As we mentioned a bit earlier, any controversial plays will be solved using the VAR.
I think that's brilliant.
But I love it. And then just a couple of points. So as we mentioned in the beginning, it was the whole tournament was a joint effort between the Spanish YouTuber. He's a Twitch guy also. He's called Ebi. And the dude from Barca, he's a Barca centre-back, and Shakira's husband, Gerard Piqué.
Oh, so lovely, man. Lovely. He's got it all. Yeah. He's got a fit wife, and he's got this great sport. He's there at the helm of this majestic sport.
And you know, he was taking it super seriously in the interviews. And him and the YouTube guy, Ebi, they're commentating, and they were going. You need to watch it, even for anyone who doesn't understand Spanish. You'll understand them going for it.
Yeah, I can imagine. Nuts.
Big viewing numbers too. It was streamed live on Ebi's Twitch channel. It's got 8 million total views. It peaked at 630,000 concurrent views. That's people viewing at the same time, I think. So we'll give a big shout out to the first ever balloon world champion, Francesco de la Cruz. and he's from Peru. He smashed it in the final. If you're going to watch any of it, watch the final.
That's going to be a quiz question somewhere one day.
Definitely. That'll be my first one. And yeah, and did a final little shout out to and commiserations to the Team UK. I couldn't find the name of the athlete anywhere, but I think we could get him on the show one day.
Ah, 100%. 100%. Out in the first round to Equatorial Guinea. So there is an international element to it. So you kind of represent your country slightly. So this could potentially be in the Olympics in 12 years.
You never know. You never know. Like, it was surprisingly athletic. I'll say that for it. Like, these guys were going for it. And also, not just guys. It was, that was a good point about it. Men and women can compete against each other, which is quite cool.
Yeah, not many sports that has that. We actually spoke about that before, that I think we're very limited, maybe horse racing. Three that I identified. I can't remember. Horse racing was definitely one, though.
Okay.
Not many sports where there's this cross-pollination with darts. Yes. Fallon Sherrick or something like that. Fallon Sherlock. But yeah, she's competed against the men in the darts. And yes, snooker. There was a woman that played against her ex. One of the rounds of, I can't remember what it was, the Masters, the UK Masters, something like that. But yeah, she had to play against her ex-boyfriend, which was hilarious. She lost. All right, so take us away from number four.
Okay, yeah, a bit of a spicy one. Well, it started off spicy, but after updates today, it's got a little less spicy. So tennis star Novak Djokovic will be barred from competing in the Australian Open unless he gets vaccinated. News all around the world at the moment, you know, trying it, like, as you know, about moving in and out of the States, getting certain jobs in the States. You need vaccines now. Over here in Spain, they've just reopened nightclubs and certain other larger venues. And to go to them, you need to show that you've been vaccinated. So it's a big thing all over the world at the moment. Earlier this week, a number of publications had reported that Djokovic is refusing to disclose his vaccination status and have taken that to mean he hasn't had the vaccine. And they're probably right, you know. Mm-hmm. I remember earlier in the week, I was reading about this and he was like, look, it's personal. I don't want to talk about it. See, now the thing is, with Australia, especially the Australian Open that's going to be going on soon, everyone who wishes to attend, that's staff, fans, and even the athletes, they all need to be double jabbed. The Victorian Premier, so that's like Premier's, I think it's like the leader of the state of Victoria in Australia, like their top political representative. He's responded to that story by saying no exceptions are going to be made. I don't care if it's Djokovic or no one, no exceptions. Like, if he wants to come, he's got to get the double jab. So that was the story as it was earlier in the week. It was like, all right, so Djokovic potentially vaccine hesitant, or is he full anti-vax? There was a lot of talk about that sort of thing. Now, today, a bit more info has come to light. And he gave an in-depth interview to a Serbian newspaper called Bleak, which
sounds interesting.
Just straight up, like, you don't need to read this. Everything's fine. It's Bleak. But Djokovic is now saying that the main problem is that if you're on a plane with a person who's positive, whether they're vaccinated or not, you automatically have to stay in your room for 14 days. And he went on to say that this happened to Viktor Troicki, I think that's pronounced, in January this year. Not only him, but 70 players had to be in quarantine. I've talked to a lot of players, and that's remained a bad memory for everyone. So I don't know if I'll go to Australia. I don't know what's going on. Currently, the situation isn't good at all. So trying to set the record straight there.
Yeah, he's one of, you know, quite a few high profile sports stars that have come out and not fully disclosed their vaccine status or refused to get the vaccine based on various reasons. Some of them have cited religious reasons. Some of them have cited that they wanted to do their own research to find out about the vaccine. And without trying to go down a political wormhole or any conspiracy theories, we all have a choice in this matter, or we should all have a choice about and the governance of our own bodies. And I think that's very important. Obviously, Kyrie Irving being one of the main ones over here, obviously plays for the Brooklyn Nets. He has refused to the vaccine, and he's explained to his fans and to everybody associated with him why. And I think he's got quite a lot of backing from a lot of people in New York, because obviously... Right. There's been a lot of mandate towards, first responders, policemen, saying you have to get the vaccine or else you lose your job. Obviously, these top sports people, they've got a decision. They've got a choice whether they go to these tournaments or whether they play half a season, because, you know, they're multimillionaires and they get, you know, they got money in the bank. A lot of people that haven't got this choice, they have to take it or literally fall on hard times. So I think, you know, all these situations where it's kind of like, oh, you're not allowed to play if it's double jabs. At the end of the day, I don't feel sympathy for sports people. Do you know what I mean? That say, oh, you know, I can't play because of the jab. Because they're not in the same situations as the average Joe, are they?
Yeah, the stakes are completely different. Yeah, I get you on that.
All right, so number five. Finally, Shooter McGavin, one of the great fictional sports villains of recent memory from the film Happy Gilmore. He posted a picture. So basically the actor that plays him or whoever's running the Twitter account posted a picture of an out of shape Adam Sandler with the caption, "Still can't believe I lost a 4-stroke lead to this guy." So Happy Gilmore still goes down. It's probably my favorite Sandler film of all time, with perhaps Waterboy in close second. And it was actually the 25th anniversary of the film this February. And it still holds up for comedic value, man. The actor that plays Shooter, Christian McDonald, says that even after 25 years, he gets Happy Gilmore quotes shouted at him every day.
That it's a brilliant movie, and that's great. That's great that people still shout quotes here, even now.
And apparently, he still keeps in character. So, like, if people start talking to me, he reverts back to the character of Shooter McGavin, even like 25 years after he was in the film.
I love it. I hate the people who try to run away from the biggest role, you know? That's what people love you for. So big, big respect to someone who can own it, even if it's an embarrassing role. I'm not saying this is, but, you know, someone who's had an embarrassing but loved role 20 years ago and they just own it. Like Rick Astley, you know, he had that cheesy song.
Never gonna give you up. Never gonna... I bet you every time he goes out, like if he goes out for dinner with his wife, he probably gets that.
Huge respect to him. He owns it. He plays it live. He played it with the Foo Fighters a few months ago.
He just comes out. He's only got like two. He's only got like three songs. He's like, all right, well, I'm gonna play like. I'm going to play the jazz version. I'm going to play the country version. And I'm going to play the original version. Everyone's going to be happy.
Yeah. But yeah, big respect for people like that. They know what they're known for, you know? They know why people like them. And they give their fans what they want. And I think that's cool.
Absolutely. All right, we're going to move on to the footy talk. So this is from last weekend. We're going to have a little bit of review of the main European games on Super Sunday. So we're going to delve into the United Liverpool game. We're going to gloss over. I said we're going to get a little bit deeper actually than we thought. We're going to get into the Barcelona game and what's happened since then, because obviously you're in Barcelona. You've had the privilege of speaking to some of these Spanish fans, these Barcelona fans, and I want you to try and encapsulate their anger and their frustration with what's been happening there. And obviously now Ronald Koeman's been sacked after losing 1-0 against Rayo Vallecano. We are going to get into that in a little bit, but we'll start off talking about Manchester Liverpool. Obviously 5-0, absolute destroying. The first time anyone has ever scored a hat-trick at Old Trafford, which I find remarkable. I think in the Premier League era, yes, so since 1992-93. There's never been a guy that scored a hat-trick at Old Trafford. So Mo Salah achieved that feat just after the second half when he got his third. You know, obviously, another manager that's highly, highly under pressure. The game was a disaster in terms of, I think, Man United's defending, how they set up. Obviously, they lost 3-2 to Atalanta midweek. Oh, sorry, they won 3-2 against Atalanta midweek, but they went 2-0 down. It could have been a lot more. It could have been a lot worse. Obviously, Cristiano Ronaldo got them out of trouble on that occasion. And then after that game, Paul Scholes, who's been in the news for other things this week, he basically said, if they play like this, if they start the game like this against Liverpool, they're going to get destroyed. And so they did, to be honest. They were completely picked apart by Liverpool. Their high press wasn't a high press. It was kind of a half press. They just got dismantled. You know, really no pressure on the ball. Mistakes at the back, like no communication between Harry Maguire and Luke Shaw. And that was just the first half. And then obviously second half, Paul Pogba, you know, had his sort of ignominious 10 minutes where he came on, you know, didn't do much and then got sent off. I think it was within 10 minutes. for a horrible two-footy challenge, something you just can't do in football anymore. So really, it seems like a bit of a disaster at United at the minute. I mean, how much longer does Solskjaer get? Obviously, he's a player that used to play for United. He didn't really have much sort of managerial history going into United. Obviously, he was at Molde, I think, in Norway. So I think that was his only gig before he went to United. So not an experienced manager, but definitely a loved player. Do these sort of players get longer than, say, a player that has no attachment to the club, do you think?
In my opinion, my not quite, obviously, fairly uninformed opinion, nah. I'd get rid of... what I do notice from football fans is there's a lot of sentimentality a lot of the time. I hear it from you sometimes when you talk about football. And I hear it from my brother, you know, he's a huge, huge football fan. But it's a business. It's a business. And like any business, and this works business all across the world, as someone who's good at a job might not be good at managing people in that job. It's not the same skill. Management, like I think you and Jim were talking about this last week, management is about managing people, you know, looking after what your team needs. And of course, in football, it's like working out all tactics and stuff like that, buying the right people. But though it's not always the same skill, you need to learn that skill separately. Say if you're just like a great baker, then you getting put in charge of a chain of bakeries, you're not automatically going to be good at that. And I think that's the... I think that seems to be the situation here. Like, did he manage anyone else before he got this job? Or?
Yeah, he was at Molde, a team in Norway. So, but you know, nowhere near on the stature of United. Mm. You know, I mean, I think he was relatively successful there. But and obviously he's Norwegian, so it was kind of like a good transition between his playing career and his coaching career. So, but Manchester United are a different beast, man. There's a lot of expectation within that club and the fan base. Do you know what I mean? And obviously you talk about man managing and, you know, there being a big difference between playing the game and coaching the game. As we all know, like it's a separate entity in itself, really. And one of the best guys at doing that was Alex Ferguson, a coach that was there for, you know, how long was he there? Over 20 years, you know, since he went there from Aberdeen in like the 80s, mid 80s, and won basically everything there was to win multiple times at United. He wasn't a great tactician. You know, Fergie wasn't an amazing tactician. He was just a great man manager. He knew which players to put his arm around and which players to give a kick up the arse, man. Like, he knew how to deal with each one of his players, you know, on a personal level. And I think that's the important thing. If you are one of those managers, delegate those tasks and responsibilities to your coaches that are good tacticians. If you're more of a tactician, then you take that and you have somebody that comes in and perhaps does the sort of like deals with the emotional side of the game. Because at the end of the day, these footballers are people, you know what I mean? They're people. They have emotions and feelings and they're upset. They're happy. They're sad. So, and then they get anxiety. So you have to manage that as well. Do you know what I mean? Having an emotional intelligence level is very, very important. I'm not saying that Solskjaer hasn't got this, but I think what he's failing on is the tactical side of it. It seems like a lot of the players are kind of losing faith in his ability to set up tactical instructions prior to games efficiently. So if that's the case, he's not good enough to be at Old Trafford, in my opinion.
I think you're right. And something you said a second ago, I think you nailed it there about Ferguson delegating. That's what makes a good leader. A good leader knows their strengths and their weaknesses, and they know the strengths of their team. So like you said, maybe he wasn't the best tactician, but he got certain coaches to do that. So it looks like he's not delegating properly. That seems to be the thing. And I agree with you. I think he's probably not going to be around for much longer.
Nah, it doesn't seem like I don't think there's any end game. I don't see any way of Ole avoiding it, really. You know, even if he does, the only thing he could do from now is go on and win either the title or the Champions League. I think they're the only two things that realistically save his job. I think everything else, they'll be looking for a more experienced manager to come into the role. Because I mean, look, Ferguson, I think he had Mike Phelan there, who was a great coach. He went on to coach, be a head coach of teams as well after his sort of period of his tenure as one of the United's coaches. And they had the Portuguese coach, I think Queiroz, that might be his name. I can't remember exactly what his name was, but at the Portuguese coach, that was a great tactician there. So he knew he had his coaching staff around him. I think one of the great quotes is, you know, as a CEO or a leader or whatever of a business, you need to make sure you aren't the smartest person in the room. You need to surround yourself with intelligent people. And I think that's what, I don't know whether Solskjaer's done that. Do you know what I mean? I don't know whether he's got people around him that are good enough to basically be his team, be his coaching staff. Do you know what I mean?
That's a brilliant quote, by the way. I've heard that one before, but that's absolutely any good leader should try and follow that rule. And I think you're right. The results should be different if you followed that rule. That's the way of thinking. So yeah, it looks like he probably isn't.
Yeah, and I suppose, you know, football is a purely results-based industry. Realistically, there isn't anything else that owners and, you know, because owners, as you say, the majority of them now is strictly business, isn't it? There's no sentiment really from the owners. The only sentiment that gets involved in football nowadays comes from the fans. So they're looking at football clubs as a way to make money, and they can't make money if they don't see results. You can't have 2 years of development. And it looked like Solskjaer was going to be one of these development managers where he was bringing through a lot of the youth players. But after 18 months, if you're not seeing results, then it's no good, is it? They're not going to accept that. You know, you have like maybe a year. The NFL do it quite well. They have like sort of what you'd call like a clear out. So it's kind of like, all right, we're going to basically get rid of all the dead wood, start from the bottom. We're going to draft a new quarterback because we've been terrible for like 5 years. We're going to draft a new QB, get him in, and we're going to build from there. We'll give him a year. Even if we lose every single game in the season, we're going to let him develop. And NFL, we don't really see this with football teams. We don't see somebody saying to a manager, right, we don't care what happens. Just go out there just develop our young group of players. And the only reason I think that this isn't allowed in football is because we have relegation. They don't have relegation. So no matter what happens, they'll be playing the same teams, getting the same, pretty much the games, the same gate receipts. Maybe they'll be slightly down. If you've lost every game in the season, there's probably going to be, say, 25% of the fans that aren't going to come, which happens with every sport. But that cemented knowledge that they know they're going to come back and be in the same league and the same kind of revenue streams every year. Whereas in the Premier League, you can't afford to do that, can you? Because you fall out of the Premier League. What does that mean? It's loss of income, isn't it? So there's a big thing. And especially with Solskjaer, if you don't finish in the Champions League positions, it's a loss of income. Basically, I think he's on a nice edge. We'll move on to Barca Real and talk about a manager that was on a knife's edge when we wrote the script and has since gone. So I'm going to get your input on this as well. So Real Madrid, they took the first El Clasico of the season against Barcelona 2-1. On the weekend, on Sunday, with two goals coming in injury time and electric finish of the game, Barcelona dropped into what I would call uncharted territory for them as they sit ninth. And I think that might have dropped to 10th now because they've lost to Rayo Vallecano during the week yesterday. And with Real Sociedad taking a surprise seat on top pile in La Liga after 10 games. So this is, I would say, it's probably one of the most competitive starts to a La Liga season in recent memory. There are six teams separated by only 3 points. This was as of Sunday. Sociedad, Real Madrid, Sevilla, Atletico, Real Betis and Osasuna make up the top six. And I think Rayo Vallecano just snuck in there as well. So some familiar faces, but also teams that probably got nosebleeds. You know what I mean? Being up that high in the league. Obviously, now we know Koeman has been sacked. He wasn't given a good situation. He was given probably the most horrible position as Barcelona coach as there ever has been. You know what I mean? He's best player, one of the greatest players we've ever seen has just left. He's got players that are on like extremely high wages that aren't playing a game. He's got players that are injured. He's got players that have no business being in the Barcelona shirt. For example, Memphis Depay. I think Luke de Jong, Marcus Braithwaite that's been there. So he's got players that they're just not Barcelona quality. And then he's also having to develop these new lads, Ansu Fati. He's got the new lads that they've just signed, 18-year-old Spanish player that's just signed $1 billion release clauses. So they won't be leaving anytime soon. But do you think Koeman, and I'm gonna let you sort of use your, because I know you've been speaking to a few of your friends about this and what their sort of opinions on Koeman was prior to the sacking. Would you say, you know, the general reaction with the locals in Barcelona, is it going to be, right, yeah, we're glad he's gone.
I'm pretty sure that's going to be the way. But so, yeah, like you said, I've reached out to a few people around here, namely one of my friends, Oscar. So big shout out to Oscar. And he gave us a nice quote there. He basically just said, yeah, Kerman's no good, but it's not like he can work any miracles with the team he's got. I get a feeling that sentiment might be held by a few people around here in Barcelona. I did catch the end of that game in a bar yesterday. There was only a couple people in watching it, but generally when the final whistle was blown, just a few old guys in there, they just went, oh, fuck, kind of thing. And, you know, just like cursed and then immediately left the bar. Because that's something that's kind of common here. When there's a big football game, as soon as the match finishes, win or lose, everyone disappears out of the pub after.
Yeah, it's like they've specifically gone there just to watch it, right? But why don't you just watch it at home then? Do you know what I mean? I'd rather go in and have a few beers and maybe like have drown my sorrows or have a few celebratory drinks afterwards. But yeah, it does feel like there is a big European culture with that. They just get up and leave straight away.
Exactly. People don't seem happy. So reached out to a few different friends. Then I came across, so they all had similar ideas to my friend Oscar there. Basically, he's no good, but we've been in shit for a long time. It's not completely his fault. Now, I did see an article the other day after the El Clasico. There was a group of, did you see this? A group of Barca fans attacked Kerman's car as he was driving out of the stadium. Yeah. Maybe it was just a small thing that was blown up in a newspaper, which is common. But yeah, there was a bit of footage taken from a phone. His car's leaving and there's just people just chanting at him, kicking the car, chucking stuff at the car. So it looks like hardcore fans are fuming and they're probably going to see this as a step in the right direction now he's been sacked.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what. I feel like it's just another addition to the nightmare and horror story that I'd say Barcelona are going through at the minute. Well, comparative, because like obviously I'm a Birmingham City fan, and you'd know about this because your brother's a big Blues fan. We know That's about right. disappointment and heartbreak. Do you know what I mean? But we've become so accustomed, so accustomed to disappointment and heartbreak that it's kind of like, all right, we have this kind of like, how can I say, this laissez-faire attitude towards our club. And it's just like, all right, well, yeah, we're terrible again, but we understand. And that makes the good times even better. But for Barcelona, for a club that's been so synonymous with winning for such a long time, I can imagine to these old boys sitting in the caf or in the bar or whatever, watching this game and just being in disbelief and just being so frustrated and angry because all they've known is greatness and winning. For them to now be absolutely average so far this season, losing in the Champions League, do you know what I mean? Getting humbled in the Champions League, not just losing. And then obviously, you know, getting beat by teams like Rayo Vallecano in the Spanish League. It's just, it's not good enough for the standard that Barcelona have set themselves in the recent years.
A question for you. How long have Barca been as dominant as they were? Has this been generational? Is this
this is multi-generational because...
Wow, really?
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't know the figures off the top of my head, but they've been a constant state of winning the La Liga, I would say, every three or four seasons, at least once, for 35 years, maybe, getting on close to 40 years, because it would have been the period of when they had Johan Cruyff, and Cruyff was one of the huge, and Rinus Michels, two Dutch, a coach and a player, that had a massive influence in Barcelona's way of playing their footballing philosophy, which is what has turned into tiki-taka. But that was what the kind of this, I think it was a Spanish, I think it might have been Guillem Balag or someone like that, that coined this term of short possession-based football, building in it with using short passes and moving the ball sort of around the field with short passing. So kind of like the antithesis of direct long ball football that we were accustomed to in the UK for so many years. So, you know, it was the Dutch sort of players like Johan Cruyff and then the manager, Rinus Michels, that developed this philosophy, this tiki-taka philosophy. We'll call it that, but it's not, but we'll call it that.
Right.
And then, but that's been embedded there for such a long time. Obviously, you've got La Masia, which is their youth system that so many great players have come up from and, you know, that basically every young footballer aspires to go and, you know, to go and be part of the La Masia Academy and learn how to like truly play football in a great way. become a great player using that philosophy. And it's kind of like the Ajax philosophy as well. So there's a massive amalgamation of different footballing philosophies and cultures, which is kind of grew into, and they've grew into this huge, like, I don't know, sporting conglomerate, basically, that they are today. Do you know what I mean? They're not just a football club. They've got basketball teams associated with hockey teams. So they're just a sports organization. So they're much bigger than just a football club.
They, I don't know if you know, they have a TV channel over here. Just on the, not a special TV channel, just as you're flicking through the TV channels, there's Barcelona football team, the TV channel.
And she goes, they're like a brand, you know what I mean? They're a household brand, aren't they, in Spain? Mm-hmm. And around the world. Their crest is probably like one of the most instantly recognizable crests around the world. And obviously they've had this such a lot for a long time, this association with Messi since he came on the scene in 2004, whatever, as a long haired, like scruffy looking, like little guy that was like so good when he first came on the scene. So he's been around for such a long time that he's become synonymous with Barcelona. Now he's not there. Obviously, they've lost that and the quality around the team and that sort of like star attitude that they had. But there's also the sense that, all right, maybe they're not as great as we thought they are. Do you know what I mean? Maybe was Messi really carrying that team? Do you know what I mean? I think he was pushing their team into another dimension in terms of like commercial appeal, I think, for sure. Constantly taking their commercial appeal to a new level. Now is the interest declining? Because they had like, I think they had 45% of what they could have had against in the Champions League attendance. This is, they had 45% attendance against Dynamo Kiev. That would be unheard of with Messi. I think you would expect 80%. So I think there's a general interest that's come away from Barcelona so far. And also now, because of their mismanagement of the club for such a long time from their owners, that they're in massive financial trouble, over €1 billion in debt. So they've got serious amounts of loans to pay. And the fact that they haven't got their star player anymore, it's kind of like taking the sheen off what it means to be Barcelona.
How do you be so successful, a football team, and be in €1 billion debt? How does that happen?
You've probably asked the same questions to some of these huge corporations that are probably billions in debt. I mean, I don't know if it runs in the same way as like traditional businesses, but a lot of these football teams are liquid, like they run in liquidity. So they basically offset loans and they borrow money, and it's over, you know, a huge periods of time. Banks will probably lend them money and it doesn't need to be paid back for 10 years or whatever. And then obviously their idea is that, all right, if we spend this money on transfers, that player will be worth X amount of money more in 5 years. So then we can pay back the interest. But I just feel like once again, what's the end game? How do you pay back €1 billion? I don't know how any club goes about doing that. How do you pay that back?
No idea. I've got to say, I was impressed before, but actually speaking to you about football, you truly are an encyclopedia of the sport.
I mean, I do
it
get
amazes
things wrong
me your
lot,
knowledge but... of football history.
Yeah,
we'll have comments going, that's fine.
Yeah, I'm busy chatting bollocks yet again. But yeah, Kerman, he's gone. I don't know what's next for him, because he's, to be honest, he wasn't in high regard when he went there. I thought he went there because he's an ex-Barcelona player, obviously Dutch again. So they probably thought, right, he's going to try and embed the same sort of philosophy that Rinus Michels and Johan Cruyff brought to the club. But it hasn't worked out for him. He wasn't good at Everton. I think he was with the Holland national team periodically. He wasn't successful there. So I feel like he has been successful in a handful of jobs now. So I don't know what's next for him. But Barcelona, I would imagine they're probably going to go stick the type and get somebody in that has probably got connections with the club. I won't be surprised if it's going to be an ex-player or an ex-manager. Could be somebody that's managed them before. So we will see. I haven't seen what the latest odds are and who's in the betting on who's going to be the next manager, but we'll leave that there and we'll be wet the mouth with the anticipation, seeing who's going to go in there and see if they can turn the fortunes around of such a great club in that city. We'll quickly go over into Juve, which was the third match of that Super Sunday in Italy. It was a stalemate in the Derby d'Italia. between Inter Milan and Juventus. Inter raced into an early lead after a thunderous Kananoglu strike ricocheted off the upright and fell straight into the path of journeyman Edin Dzeko, who had the simple task of rolling the ball into the empty net. Juventus, who are another team, you know, struggling to adjust to life after losing a star player, Cristiano Ronaldo. They equalised very late on after the referee was alerted to a fairly contentious foul that looked to be on the edge of the penalty area. And it was finally awarded with the help of VAR, another team that had been subject of cheating, as we spoke about the Houston Astros. If you haven't checked it out on Netflix, this is this to all our listeners, check out Bad Sport. I think there's about 5 episodes, right? And they talk about the Juventus match fixing scandals of the sort of 2006, 2007, I think it was, with referees and the owner of Juventus basically putting referees in place that could influence games. Very, very interesting. There's a football one. There's one about cricket. There's one about motorsport. So it's a really, really interesting series. So go and check that out, Bad Sport on Netflix. But Simeone Inzaghi, the Inter coach, was sent off for obviously calling the referee a you-know-what after this decision. And the resulting penalty was dispatched by Paulo Dybala and the game finished 1-1. So obviously Juventus going through a similar post-superstar shift, same as Barcelona, as we just mentioned. Not the same magnitude, but losing one of the all-time greats, you know, such as Cristiano. Does this period of, you know, losing that a player of that quality and of that magnitude, does it take a bit of an adjusting to like a new style? Like, so obviously not everything's revolving around one player. And obviously there's a bit of a gap between Juve and the other teams in their league, same as Barcelona. Juve are 10 points adrift of first place Napoli and AC Milan. And they're sitting sixth. So not as bad as Barcelona, but still on the same sort of level. Both these teams, and we talk about the two players that have basically had held the flag for the sport over the last, 15 years? Cristiano Ronaldo is, 36? Messi's 34, I believe. So I think they're about 2 years apart. But they've been the two players that have been on the cover of everything to do with soccer, haven't they? For the last over 15 years. So, you know, I can imagine this is a huge shift for teams. Like, how do they manage Messi being at Barcelona for his entire career? Ronaldo was just in Juve as a kind of like passing through almost. So not the same levels. But once again, Juventus, a great club, won 9 Serie A titles on the trot. And then, you know, they struggled, I think, last year to even make the Champions League. So do you think these like these footballing powerhouses, obviously Man United went through it as well, where they were superior for so long. But Juve were extremely dominant, 9 Serie A titles on the trot. What do you think is going wrong there with Juventus? What can these huge dominance, these periods of dominance, is there a sort of like, I don't know, fallout, like a calm down from these huge periods of dominance, do you think?
Now, as you were sort of telling this story, something that jumped to my mind was the fall of the Roman Empire. I mean, it's obviously a completely different thing, but you know, many different reasons, all agree, different things contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire. But one interesting thing I did read once is that for an empire of that size to keep being profitable, to keep being sustainable, it needs to keep growing. It needs to get more people within it, more trade, more money, more resources. And at some point, you get to a point where you can't grow anymore. And it seems like some of these teams, especially if they're racking up huge amounts of debt, they're trying to get more fans coming in, they must have just hit a boiling point. And another thing that happens with the falls of empires and in huge businesses is the loss of a good leader. And like you said, star players, like, I mean, they're not leading the team, people like Cristiano Ronaldo and Messi, but they're more or less leaders, to like a locker room leader, I would imagine. Now, the loss of a force like that on your team, it's going to play havoc with the morale. That's just my two cents. I'm going to say it's unsustainable growth and the loss of leadership type people on the team.
No, I think that's a fantastic comparison. I really do. I think you could say that players like Messi and Cristiano Ronaldo are like emperor-like, you know, personalities in the dressing room. They basically pick the team. I think that's probably been one of Solskjaer's problems at United. He's got a player in Cristiano Ronaldo that perhaps is bigger than him. Well, he's definitely bigger than him in terms of his personality. So I wonder if the players are thinking, you know, if he doesn't manage Ronaldo correctly, if he isn't equipped psychologically, emotionally, to be able to deal with a superstar of his magnitude as Ronaldo is, that's going to reflect badly on his team. So I wonder, 100%. I wonder if this that same kind of you know there's the same kind of backlash from teams like Juventus and Barcelona of them losing their star players. So it's just adjustment to life without your leader or without your emperor, basically. Do you know what I mean?
If you're trying to lead something and there's someone below you in the hierarchy who everyone likes more, that's got to be a hard situation to be in. That's
yeah, for sure. Because then you get into a scenario where you're having to kind of like, against your will, like stamp down your authority. Maybe you're not that type of character. You're not that type of coach where like an authoritarian, maybe you're a bit more sort of laissez-faire and you like to, you know, give democracy to the dressing room and everybody chips in. If you've got a player like Ronaldo, perhaps that's a different way. You have to take that in a different approach. So yeah, I don't know, man. But yeah, it's interesting to see, but it's also very, very interesting for the game of football. You know what I mean? We got teams that are competing now in these top European leagues that perhaps haven't been for a long time. Obviously, we had Leicester that won the league a few years ago. It was brilliant, wasn't it? It was brilliant for the sport, yeah. Man. 5,000 to 1 they were at the start of the season or something. So it's absolutely huge, man. And it really piqued the interest of the Premier League. I mean, I've spoke to this about Jim like on multiple occasions about and comparing it to NFL. The way the NFL works is you do have teams that have like sustained periods of dominance, such like Tom Brady did with New England Patriots. Obviously, he was there for like the majority of his career until he moved away. So he won like 7 championships with New England, which is basically like a feat that, you know, no quarterback will probably ever do again in the history of the sport. So, you know, those periods of dominance in NFL, they do fluctuate because of the way their draft system set up. Whereas in football, it's basically going to be whoever buys the best players and whoever pays the best players the best amount of money is going to be successful. So, and this is the kind of like model that teams are going down now. Obviously, with Newcastle being bought out by the Saudi Arabian government, you know, that's going to be an interesting period of football in history in say 5 years. Like how is that going to, you know, change the landscape of the Premier League? Do you know what I mean? So it's
hugely, I imagine.
It's going to be a crazy 5 years. Do you know what I mean? And I don't think we're not going to see this kind of like refreshing periods of like teams like Rayo Vallecano beating Barcelona, teams like small teams like Leicester winning the league at odds of 5,000 to 1. I think these are going to be few and far between in 10 years because it's just going to be dominated by money and the best teams or whichever teams are going to be the best teams based on their financial expenditure, essentially.
I think you're absolutely right. I think we seem to be in a special moment with the falling of these giants and people scrambling to get to the top, different teams scrambling. And we're seeing interesting results like Leicester winning the league and things like that. I think you're absolutely right. And I think you are right. In 10 years, it will go back to like how it was when we were like when we were in school, when it was just Man U and Arsenal were at the top all day long, every year, that kind of thing. And Chelsea, I think. Yeah. I think there'll be another period, like you said, another period like that. And then maybe the new giants fall 10 years after that and we get this weird sort of cycle kind of thing happening.
Yeah, maybe it's like 10 years of dominance. Then there's like a kind of a transition period of 2 or 3 years where there's like a power struggle between, right, which team has the best players and which team spends the most money to get to the top. And then there'll be another period of dominance. Like, you know, Manchester City are currently there peaked in their period of dominance. They've won like, what, 3 titles since they won the first one in 2012, I think now. And they're dominating on the same level as Man United was in that period, you know, sort of like late 90s. And then, you know, obviously Arsenal were a bit of an anomaly, but they did spend money, but they had that invincible season in, what, 2004, something like that. So I do feel like football is forever cemented. We're always going to have dominant figures in the game. We'll go through the, I'll do like a rapid Premier League review. And then we've kind of got like, Jim's combat sports to go through. Obviously, he can't be here today. Yeah, he's off learning magic tricks with Darren Brown, isn't he?
He is. Hope he's having a good night. I've always wanted to see Darren Brown live. I'm a bit jealous.
Yeah, so I'll rattle through this and then we'll sort of go over Jim's notes and we'll just chat about the two big fights that were from last weekend. So the Premier League game review. So Friday night, Arsenal improved again, making them undefeated in the league since their 5-0 humbling by Manchester City. That including 4 wins in 6 games, they down the Aston Villans 3-1. Thomas the Tuchel engine rolls on as Chelsea dismantled Norwich 7-0 as the Canaries still search for their first win of the campaign. Mason Mount scoring a hat-trick after we said he weren't all that on this podcast, further cementing the notion that we haven't got a scoop what we're talking about. Leeds get a last gas equaliser at home to Wolves from the spot as the Yam Yams resurgent continues. Make that 10 points from their last 4 games and another goal for Korean starlet Hwang Hee-chan as he grabs his 4th in 6 appearances this season. Everton were 2-1 up at home to Watford going into the 78th minute. Then the game ends up, checks notes, what, 5-2 to the Hornets? God knows how that happened. But Everton defending like a bunch of toffees in that final 10 minutes. And Rafa Benitez has a lot of work to do in the sweet shop. So Maxwell Cornet, he had huge pressure on him as he's Burnley's biggest transfer signing of all time. Some of that pressure has eased considerably with a brace against Southampton. They ended up all square at 2-2. The Saudi government saw their managerless team get a first point with a spectacular piece of improvisation from Callum Wilson. Benteke has his second denied late on in the second half, all square 1-1. Manchester City, playing in their Sports Direct looking third kits, have no trouble seeing off a resurgent Brighton this season. If Grealish is worth 100 million, how much is Phil Foden worth, I ask? 2 goals and an assist for one Man City. And Leicester City continued their recovery from a poor start to the season with a 2-1 win at Brentford. Goals for Yuri Tielemans and James Maddison. And finally, Mikel Antonio scored the only goal in a win for the Hammers at home to Tottenham Hotspur. Nuno Espirito Santo in low spirits after some poor performances in recent weeks. So that's your Premier League roundup from last week.
Fantastic. A lot of action there.
Loads of action, mate. That's what I wanted to try and do. Get in 3 minutes, bish, bash, bosh, straight into the combat sports. Obviously, I'm not sure if you've had much kind of reading up on the UFC and boxing. There was basically two big events from last weekend. There was a Shakur Stevenson fight, which I watched the highlights of, but I'll be doing Jim a massive disservice going through his script. So I'm going to sort of paraphrase some of the things from his. We're going to do our best to do Jim a service and go through this.
Yeah.
So two fights. Saturday night, Shakur Stevenson became a 2-weight world champion at just 24 years old, stopping Jamel Herring in the 10th round of a fight he dominated. It might be a lazy comparison, but he's the closest thing that we've seen to Floyd Mayweather, albeit as a southpaw, Jim says. So they are huge. Huge periods of praise for him. You know what I mean? That's putting him on a pedestal there from Jim. Perfect balance, frightening hand speed, multi-layered defense that makes him very difficult to pin down for any length of time. He was aggressive but evasive, which is very difficult balance to strike. Ripped Herring's high guard to pieces before the ref had to step in. I think that's the first time we've seen an entire fight of his, and Jim was very impressed. So we saw what Herring can do to Carl Frampton early this year. Frampton may have been undersized and battle-worn in that fight, but you still have to be a good fighter to beat someone of this caliber, which Herring did with relative ease. Then you see what Stevenson did to Herring, and you realize Frampton probably did get out at the right time. So that was it from the boxing, really. Obviously, very impressive from him. No boxing this weekend of any real interest. Dylan White was supposed to be fighting Otto Wallin in a heavyweight contest, best of the rest match, but White pulled out with a shoulder injury. So that was really it for the boxing on that weekend. Not a massive one. We've been really spoiled, really, in terms of the big fights over the past, say, month, haven't we? Obviously, we had that Usyk-Joshua fight where Usyk just absolutely dominated him. He was coming up to heavyweight, you know, Joshua was, you know, is he one of the best heavyweights, you know, of a generation? And then Usyk just absolutely picked him off, to be honest. It was far too quick for him, was far too technical for him. Obviously, Joshua was giving the big noise about, oh, I'm going to murder you on the rematch. But I just feel like we all know it's just talk with Joshua. I think he's lost his fear factor.
He may have, though. I did read something recently. He's changed his trainer. He's gone back to an old trainer. So maybe we're going to see some different tactics. What surprised me was, so he's known, maybe I heard this from you guys on the podcast. I apologize if it's something you've thought about before, but he's known to be a bully in the ring. That's his skill. He's a bruiser. Yeah. He hits hard. He's strong. He bullies. And for some reason, he decided to try and outbox a very skilled boxer and obviously lost. So hopefully, if they have the rematch, he goes back to what he's good at and maybe a bit more competitive match. Maybe it's going to be a bit more exciting.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, he tried to fight fire with fire against Usyk and he got seriously burnt.
He tried to fight fire with fire, even though he's got a big pack of water.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
He could have used to put that fire out.
The fire hydrant, literally use it, you know what I mean? Exactly. I think that was the one of the main criticisms of his tactics going into that fight is, I think a lot of people were surprised about how well he did in trying to match Usyk technically. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But it was just like be a bit more aggressive, lean on him a bit more, try and tire him out, wear him out. Do you know what I mean? I don't think he managed to do that. And I think it comes down to the fact that he hasn't really got a good chin. So I don't think Joshua, he doesn't particularly take a punch very well, as we saw against Andy Ruiz when he got that huge shocking defeat. Yeah, he got knocked down three times, I think, by Ruiz. Three or four times. And obviously Ruiz took his belt. And then he was much better in the rematch, but we all expected that. Mm-hmm. So I wonder if something similar will happen against Usyk, but Usyk's a different kettle of fish, obviously, to Andy Ruiz. So it's going to be a fascinating second fight. And then obviously we had the Wilder versus Fury third edition of that fight, which was incredible. And you know, me and Jim went as far to say as like, you know, fight of the century, well, of this century anyway. So I think it was huge. It was huge. Absolutely brilliant fight. End to end, wasn't it? Really, you didn't really know which way it was going to go. It was back and forth, swinging back and forth. You didn't know, you didn't know who was going to knock who out at any one moment.
That's the thing, you know. So many other publications or comments you see online, they all say, it was competitive at the beginning, and then Fury dominated. And in hindsight, yeah, you can say that. But I agree completely with what you just said. When I was watching it live, I had no idea what was going to go on. We were texting each other during it, of course. Yeah, I had literally you didn't know what was going. Anything could have happened at any second. It was fantastic.
The intrigue with somebody like Deontay Wilder being in a fight is, even though he was absolutely exhausted by say the fourth round, he'd already been down. Was it once in the third?
He
still had the ability, and he still got that power, that raw power to knock Fury out at any moment, man. And obviously, the fight was finished in the 11th, but there was rounds, I think, in the 9th or the 10th, where he was looking all right, man. He looked like he could seriously hurt Fury, man. So it was a fantastic fight. Obviously, we want to see more of that from the heavyweight division, because there is times where the heavyweight division can be quite slow. You know, it can be a bit of a grueling contest. So it was amazing to see two geezers just absolutely go for each other, man, and like leave it all out there. Do you know what I mean? So as we said, we were absolutely like spoiled in terms of the big fight. So nothing too much to write home about this weekend, but the UFC keeps on rolling, man. That train keeps on rolling. They're generating such massive interest. And there was a huge, interesting fight on the weekend. Marvin Vettori versus Paulo Costa, and this was an absolutely fascinating fight, man. It was one of those where you're thinking, how is Marvin Vettori taking this amount of punishment? How does any human being manage to get punished as much as he did and still end up as a victor? It was unbelievable. He beat fellow former title challenger Paulo Costa. It was just a main event at Apex in Las Vegas. Obviously, not a huge card, man. It was on ESPN Plus. It wasn't like, you know, pay-per-view or anything like that. The build-up to the fight, Jim says, may have substantial repercussions in the future of the promotion. So the fight was scheduled and signed at middleweight, which is 185 pounds, with a pounds grace in non-title bouts. So obviously, you got to make weight, or else they call it what they call a catch weight. So, you know, we don't want these catchweight fights nowadays that are a bit of a joke, like Logan Paul fighting whoever he's fighting and he's about 50 pounds heavy or whatever. Mayweather, you know what I mean? Mayweather, did he fight Jake Paul or Logan Paul? I think it was Logan Paul that he fought, wasn't he?
I think Logan Paul, but yeah, huge weight difference, you're right, yeah.
Yeah, huge, huge weight difference in these sort of like exhibition catchweights. But obviously the competitive stuff, you need to be making weight. Paulo Costa arrives in Las Vegas and says he can't make the weight. Obviously, he arrives there. And he rings up Dana White and says, "Like, look, I'm not going to make the weight." And I think the UFC wanted to keep the fight alive. So they re-sign at a catch weight of 195 pounds. So now they're like, all right, you can't make 185. Fair enough. Make 195. So apparently this is pretty unusual. I don't think this happens very often. And Dana White wasn't happy in his post-fight comments. But Custer comes back and says he can't make that either.
Not trying at all. What was he doing in the training camp?
He's got days to do. Yeah, exactly. So, and he had been training because this guy looked in imperious shape, man. Like, he's a heavy, heavy, heavy guy. Really, really top heavy, man. Great physique. So I don't know whether he didn't want to lose the weight. We'll have to talk about this next week, maybe, if we can get it in with Jim. I don't know if he didn't want to lose the weight or he couldn't. I don't know why. I don't know what reasons behind it, but he said he couldn't make 195. And by this point, it all hung on Vettori. I hope he gets a nice bonus for agreeing to re-sign again at 205. So 20 pounds heavier than basically what the fight was meant to be billed at, which is a full weight class above. And since then, Dana White has said that Paulo Costa, after losing eventually against Vettori, will have to fight at light heavyweight and not a middleweight, I believe. So Jim was saying that, you know, this might have lasting repercussions because now all fighters, they've been seen, they can negotiate their way between weight classes. And you know, he thinks there's going to be a lot of players, a lot of competitors that are going to try it. So from UFC's perspective, after this main event, they might be inclined to show fighters a little bit more freedom because it was an absolute barnstormer. So the fight itself, Costa's right leg, this is straight from the horse's mouth. Costa's right leg was a dangerous weapon in the fight to the legs, body or head. His rear side kicks had the potential to end the fight and he landed a shit ton of them. How Vettori stood up is a mystery to me. And a mystery to Jim, obviously. He also blocked and slipped a lot of his way inside where he could land quick combinations of punches and elbows before disengaging. He always tried to move forward with pace, but he needed to be cautious. More than once, Costa caught him with a head kick that would have knocked out a mere mortal. And I completely agree with that. Some of these head kicks straight to the side of the face, slapping against his face, were just unbelievable.
I saw those. I caught the highlights of this. And yeah, those head kicks were unreal. But the fact that Vettori took them, did you see Costa's face once he landed a clean, an amazing head kick? Like, you heard the smack, like that. You heard the smack. It bounced off Vittori's head. Vittori's standing, conscious and ready to go, like nothing had happened.
Yeah.
Costa looked, he kind of looked angry and scared. Like, what is this guy?
Now, the geezer. The geezer looks like an absolute unit, an animal, man. Michael Bisping was saying that, when you're training in the gym with pads, you want to try and get that sort of like snap against the pads, that sound. That's when you know you've got like the sort of the technique of the kick, right? And, you know, the right amount of like kickback and stuff like that. And he was saying, you do it in the gym on the pads and you get that nice sound, but you don't actually hear that sound when you're fighting somebody because you don't get that sort of clean connection. He was saying, I was sitting ringside and I could hear the same snap that you get in the gym off the pads on Vittori's face. And he was saying that's how powerful these kicks were and how good technically they were. And he was just eating them up, man. Just chewing these kicks up like nothing was happening. Oh, dear. So, I mean, even Vettori, he said after the fight, he thought maybe Costa's weight problems stemmed from him not being ready. But he, like, after the fight, he was like, yeah, he was well prepared. He just didn't want to make the weight, innit?
Honestly, you got to agree with him. And I think I saw Bisping talking about this too. He made a good point about Costa not making weight. It's disrespectful. Just in, at the end of the day, he's disrespected the fans, his opponent, Dana, big boss Dana White. It's disrespectful. That's your job. You turn up to fight, you train, and you make weight. That's part of the job.
Of course, it is, man. Yeah, you know, it's the same thing as like if me and you would turn up to our everyday job. And it's like, all right, you need to be there. I don't know. You need to bring this. You need to bring that. This is the equipment you need to bring. You need to bring a laptop. And you turn up like without your pencil, without your laptop, without, you know, completely unprepared. And you're stone. Like, yeah, stone, absolutely frazzled at your mind. And then expect to do your job. Do you know what I mean? If you're not prepared physically, you know, or mentally for your fight, then you shouldn't be there at the end of the day. But it turned out to be an absolutely great fight. So fair play to Marvin Vettori for taking that fight, because he could have been in serious trouble, man, because you shouldn't have guys that are that, you know, that powerful fighting against such huge differences, you know what I mean? So fair play to Marvin Vettori. Paulo Costa, you need to get your head screwed on. But I look forward to watching them both fight in the future, man.
Absolutely, me too. I didn't know about them before. But yeah, keen to follow them in the future, absolutely. They were both tremendous.
Yeah, so the UFC card rolls on, the train rolls on, rather, with a new card, a big boy card at the Etihad Arena in Abu Dhabi. Light heavyweight champion, the Polish power, Jan Błachowicz, defends his belt against veteran gangster Glover Teixeira in the main event. So this is going to be an interesting one. Oh, I did watch Błachowicz against Israel Adesanya a while ago, and he moved up from middleweight, the same division that Marvin Vettori is in. And Paulo Costa, Paulo Costa was meant to be midway, but now he's going to be in light heavyweight. So Paulo Costa should maybe be fighting Jan Błachowicz instead. But Israel Adesanya came up. I believe he was undefeated to try and take Jan Blachowicz's light heavyweight title. He failed, and he was brilliant that night. Błachowicz, he just looked, you could tell the weight was just a different kettle of fish. He defends, obviously, his title. You got Petr Yan and Corey Sandhagen for the interim bantamweight strap. That's going to be a really interesting fight as well. Petr Yan, I believe the last time out, he was up against Sterling, not Raheem Sterling, can't remember his first name, Aljamain Sterling. He had a great fight against him where Petr Yan was disqualified because I think he hit him when he had a knee down, which is against the rules. Basically, one of the few things you can't do in UFC. You can't kick people in the bollocks. You can't gouge their eyes, and you can't hit a man when he's down. So I think they're pretty much the only things you can't do. So that's going to be an interesting contest. And hopefully we get that rematch between Yan and Sterling in the future. And another one that's going to be good, Islam and Makhachev versus Dan Hooker in a very tasty top six showdown at lightweight. Yes. So I've got to say, Jan versus Sandhagen is the one for me and Jim. Can't see it being boring, flying knees and ninja sweeps all over the place. So that's what we've got to look forward to this weekend.
I've got to say, I'm very hyped about Islam Makhachev and Dan Hooker. Have you been following the build-up for this one?
I have not.
Oh, it's a good story. It's a good story. So Islam, you know, Islam, you remember Khabib Nurmagomedov?
Yep.
You know, one of the... He's a contender for the GOAT status, a lot of people think. Some people think,
Jim's got a poster of him in his room. Like, you know what I mean? He's got a shrine. He's got a shrine laid out to him.
He prays to him every night.
Yeah.
But no, so Islam's a training partner or something of Khabib. They're from the same gym. He's almost as deadly in the wrestling because they're from Dagestan, and these guys, a lot of the men in that region grow up learning wrestling. It's meant to be a super popular sport. And some other martial art called Sambo or Samba, I can't remember the name of it. But yeah, they're absolute monsters on the ground. Really, really amazing grappling. Now, Islam was supposed to be fighting another guy, Dos Anjos, I think. But he was injured, I think, and he had to pull out. Now, Dan Hooker is this dude from New Zealand. And in all the interviews, he seems so likable. He's got this really relaxed accent. But anyway, he's just had a fight about a month ago.
So he's coming last minute. Yeah.
Last minute. You know, he's not got time for a real training camp or anything. They're like, you know, and this is Islam. Everyone's scared of him in the division, or most of the big guys are scared of him, you know? So no one wants to take the fight. Dan Hooker's like, yeah, he puts his pants on like I do. He's a normal bloke. I'll take him, man. Let's do it. I'm excited. He's the underdog by far, but he might have a chance. I've seen his highlights, and he's an exciting fighter. They call him the Hangman. And Islam, he's just, if you're into that wrestling sort of the fighting on the ground, which not everyone is. It's not always the most exciting, but it's an elite skill to have. It's very difficult to do. It's a lot of strength. So this should be really good for me. This is the one I'm hyped about.
Great. So there you go. There's three fights that you should be hyped about and should be checking out. I'm definitely going to be, I think, I'm not sure what time it is. I'm not sure because obviously it's in Abu Dhabi. I'm not sure what time it's going to be on.
I think because I'm gonna meet some friends and we're gonna cook a nice dinner Saturday evening, I think, and we're gonna try and catch this. I think it's gonna be 8 p.m. here in Spain, so that would mean 7 p.m. in the UK.
8 p.m. Okay, main event time. All right, perfect then. Yeah, so it's gonna be.
I believe so, but I might be wrong. I might be wrong.
There you go. So yeah, that's something to definitely look out for in the UFC this weekend, and that is pretty much a wrap for this week's episode.
Fantastic! I've loved this.
Absolutely flown by, mate.
You know, happy did a good job there for you, Jim. Shout out to Jim.
You did, man. You did. That Rome reference has cemented you in the place of Ball Chat podcast history for years to come, mate. I love a good ancient Rome reference to sport. You know, with the Colosseum and that. You know, it's been a pleasure, man. And obviously, you know, it's not easy for everybody to get on and just get on and do this first time without, you know, me and Jim. We were like nervous wrecks when we first started doing this. So credit to you to just getting on and just you just chatting, especially with things that, you know, you potentially you're not as comfortable speaking about, but you still managed to handle yourself. So you did really well, mate.
Really appreciate that, mate. Thanks a lot. Yeah. It was great being in your presence, the master of the podcast game.
It's all practice, isn't it, I suppose. And, you know, and great editing techniques, great post editing techniques. That's the key. All right. So thank you for all our listeners. Obviously, one of them's on the podcast today. So you're going to listen to this back. Hopefully it'll be strange hearing your own voice. But make sure you check out all our social media channels. We're on Instagram. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter, so check us out there. Tino's got on the, he's on the Insta, so he's working hard on the Insta posts and stuff. So hopefully we'll be a bit more active on there, just to generate a bit more interest for everybody. But once again, great to have you on, Flynn, and you'll be on for the next few weeks, at least until January, hopefully, man, if you can help us out, because obviously it was going to be either me doing this on my own or me doing it with somebody that I can bounce off. So cheers for helping us out, and we should have Jim back on next week to contribute as well.
Brilliant. I'm looking forward to it. I'm excited.